Rabbi Broidowitz's Lecture 1 on Devarim, September 17, 1997.
In the book of Devarim, the fifth book of the Torah, the book of Deuteronomy. Actually, I have to say that the Greeks got it right here. You know, as you know, the names Genesis, Exodus are from the Greek. And Deuteronomy literally means the second law. And that is exactly the rabbinic name for the book of Devarim, which is called Mishneh Torah. Mishneh Torah literally means the repetition or the reiteration or the review of the law. Now those of you who are familiar with rabbinic literature of course know that there's another very, very famous work that is also called Mishneh Torah, and that is Maimonides' Code. Many, many years later, where Maimonides basically said there is the written law, there is the Torah Shebiktav, and then there is the oral law, and therefore he calls his work a repository of the oral law, which is called Mishneh Torah. But in fact, the word Mishneh Torah was appropriated much, much earlier, and it is the rabbinic term for the book of Deuteronomy. The reason why Deuteronomy is called Mishneh Torah is because much of the book is a review by Moses, shortly before his death, of the history of the Jewish people and of the various mitzvot of the Torah. However, nevertheless, it must be stated that the book of Devarim is much more than a mere review. There are many mitzvot, for example, that are totally new, that do not appear anywhere else in the entire Torah. Last week, for example, we read about the institution of Yibum. Yibum is the commandment that says that if somebody dies, if a man dies without children, levirate marriage, there is a commandment on his brother to marry the widow, to perpetuate the memory of the brother. That is Yibum. That does not appear, at least as a mitzvah, anywhere else in the Torah. The institution of a get, this Jewish divorce ceremony, appears only in the book of Deuteronomy. So, although on one level it is called Mishneh Torah, obviously it is much more than that. And of course, one of the questions that the classical commentators grapple with is, what determines what Moshe is going to repeat? Now, if he doesn't repeat everything in the preceding four books, why does he repeat or reiterate some things and not discuss other things? In other words, what exactly is the purpose? From a literary standpoint, the book of Devarim is very, very different than the rest of the Torah in terms of the narrative voice. As you know, throughout the four books of the Torah, the narrative voice is the omnipresent, omniscient narrator. In other words, the Torah is narrated in third person. God spoke to Moshe. God spoke to Moses. Paro said to Moshe. In other words, it's really God is the narrator, as it were. But the truth is, even God is not the narrator. There is, I mean, of course, in reality, there's nothing above God. But so to speak, there's an omniscient narrator who is describing what God does, what Moses does, what Pharaoh does. It is the disembodied third voice. The book of Deuteronomy is written in first person, meaning to say, instead of the Torah saying, and God spoke to Moses, it says, and God spoke to me, saying, in other words, Moses is the narrative voice of the book of Devarim. But not really. That's not really true, because the reason that is so is because most of the book is in quotation marks. In other words, the first verse is still the omniscient narrator saying, these are the words that Moses spoke. Starting from Pasuk Beth, put quotation marks in, and you close the quote at the end of the book. So it's not a true first-person narration. Rather, it is an extended quotation after the first verse. In other words, the first verse, these are the words that Moses spoke, is still the narrative voice that is talking. Now, many of you who have background in critical Bible studies know that there are a number of modern scholars, really going back to the 19th century, the Graf-Wellhausen hypothesis, the documentary hypothesis, that puts the book of Devarim as a comparatively late book. But nevertheless, my own orientation is that we're going to view this, at least from my perspective, as part of the Torah that was given, well, not given to Moses at Sinai per se, I'll talk about that too, but it was part of the Torah that, at the very least, was written down before Moses' death, and that'll be the stamp on. But again, in terms of the content and the concepts, the historical dating is much less important than is commonly assumed. The rabbinic tradition absolutely is predicated on the fact that the book of Devarim is part of the original books of the Torah. The only mystery that the Talmud discusses is who wrote the last eight verses of the Torah. Because if you look at the end of Deuteronomy, you have the text in front of you, I could show it to you. This is chapter 34. Right, we're going to read this of Simchat Torah coming up fairly soon. Chapter 34, verse 5. Chapter 34, verse 5 reads, Vayamat Sham Moshe Eved Hashem. And Moses died there. Remember, Moses was not allowed to go to Israel. Moses, the servant of God, died in the land of Moab, Al Pi Hashem, by the word of God. Vayikpor Oto Bagai. And they buried him, or he was buried in the valley, Be'eretz Moab, in the land of Moab, Mul Beit Peor, adjacent to the area called Peor, etc. Lo Yada Ish Es Kavurato, and no one knows where Moses is buried, Ad Hayom Hazeh, till this very day. The question becomes, did Moses himself, who is said to be the author of the entire Torah, did Moses write these verses and Moses died? And when did he write them? Did he write them before he died or afterwards? Now, that already is discussed in the Talmud, in the Gemara. And the Gemara, in fact, gives us two interesting interpretations. One interpretation says is that Moses wrote the whole Torah up until that point. Then, of course, he died. And the last few verses of the Torah were, in fact, completed by Joshua, his successor. So according to that, part of the Torah was in fact not authored by Moses. Another opinion says that's impossible. It is a foundation of our faith that the whole Torah was written by Moses. So who wrote the last eight verses? So the other opinion posits that Moses wrote them, and he uses the word bedema. Moses wrote them bedema. Dema is a Hebrew word, or a Hebrew derivative, dalet mem ayin. Now, the simple meaning of dema is tears. In other words, Moses wrote about his death before it took place. Moses wrote it down, but he was crying because it was before it took place. But there's another explanation of the word dema that is offered by the Vilna Gaon, where he says the following, and this is a Kabbalistic idea, that there is the Torah as it exists in our day-to-day life. Right? We have mitzvot, honor your father and mother, don't kill, don't steal. But there is also a concept of a primeval Torah, a Torah that pre-existed even the creation of the world. We are told that 2,000 years before God created the world, there was the Torah written on black fire and white fire. Now, that Torah, on the other hand, wouldn't make sense to be written in the form that we have it. Don't kill, don't steal, there are no people, etc. So the Vilna Gaon quotes Kabbalistic sources that says that the primeval Torah, which is Eish Shechorah al Eish Levana, black fire and white fire, was an unbroken sequence of letters. And the unbroken sequence of letters from the Bet of Breishit till the Lamet of Le'enei Kol Yisrael, which is the very end of the Torah, represents the divine name of God. We're talking a four-letter name or a five-letter name. If you really get into it, there's a 72-letter name of God. But lo and behold, we are told that the Torah is a 300,000 letter name of God. The whole Torah is the unbroken Shem of HaKadosh Baruch Hu from which He created the world. And therefore, the breaking up of the Torah into words is one particular application of the Torah, but it has a transcendent meaning that goes beyond that. Nachmanides points out, that is why if a Sefer Torah misses one letter, let's say you have a Sefer Torah, you're reading the Torah in the synagogue, and sometimes you may notice that a letter is cracked, one who's reading the Torah, or there's a letter that's missing. Now sometimes the missing letter is of inconsequential meaning insofar as halakha would be concerned. For example, Aharon, the name Aharon, is sometimes spelled with a vav after the resh, and it's sometimes spelled without a vav. It's pronounced the same thing, Aharon. It doesn't change the meaning. And yet the halacha is that the Torah may be invalid and you would have to take out another Torah if you have one. The Ramban, Rachmanides, ponders, why should that be so? And he explains, because the Torah has multiple layers of meaning besides the prose meaning of the divided words. It represents the divine essence of the Shekhinah, and therefore if a letter is missing, you no longer have that name. God's name is imperfect. So the Vilna Gaon suggests that the word Dema is used in Mishnayic Hebrew to mean a mixture or a jumble. And therefore, this is the dilemma. On one hand, every word of the Torah has to be inscribed by Moses. On the other hand, Moses is not going to write a lie. So he suggests Moses was directed by God to inscribe the last 8 verses, Vayamat Moshe, not as 2 words, Vayamat Moshe, but to simply write the letters in their primeval, original sequence of unbroken letters. So Joshua divided it up into the words, but Moses wrote the Torah, the letters of the Torah. You know, this is very interesting. You know, there's a lot of publicity now regarding Michael Drosnin's book, The Bible Code, and even before then, there were various seminars which explore sequences. But what they do is they have printouts of the letters of the Torah, just straight, not broken into words, so they find various patterns and future events. Now, again, without getting into the scientific validity of that, but it certainly ties in to the notion that the letters of the Torah have a transcendent significance that is ironically beyond the division of the Torah into words. In fact, there's a Kabbalistic notion, which is not the mainstream of Kabbalah, by the way. It's kind of a dissenting view, but I'll share it with you because it's very fascinating. You know, there is a Kabbalistic tradition that the world is only supposed to exist for 6,000 years. That's why you often hear that since we're now in 5,757, the Mashiach, the Messiah, has to come by the year 6,000 within the next 250 years or so. And the concept of that is that you have the 6 days of creation followed by a Shabbat. Now it says in Psalms that God's day equals 1,000 years. Elef shanim b'yeinecha. 1,000 years in your eyes, God. Ki yom etzmol. Is like a single day. So drawing on the creation analogy, where there are 6 days of creation followed by a Shabbat, the concept is that the world undergoes struggle for 6 of God's days, which is 6,000 years, and then we have a 1,000-year respite of redemption, which is the revelation of the Mashiach. But then you got a problem, because if you're borrowing the Shabbat analogy, that only gives you 1,000 years. So what happens after the 1,000 years? So the Kabbalists posited, a minority actually, this was not a majority view, an amazing thing of borrowing from another analogy, meaning we have so many analogies that there are always analogies that you can borrow to suit. And they said, well, instead of looking at the Shabbat analogy, let's look at the Shemitah analogy. A Shemitah is also a very similar cycle, that in the land of Israel, for 6 years you farm the land, and then on the 7th year, you're not supposed to farm the land. Now, again, there are different ways that some people use to get out of that. They sell the land to the non-Jew, just as we sell our chametz to the non-Jew. Again, that is what the Israeli chief rabbinate does. Other segments of the Jewish population do not accept that, and they do refrain from farming. But certainly the ideal is to refrain. Now, what happens after Shemitah? You start the cycle again, but then you go on for 7 cycles. 7 Shemitot culminates in the Jubilee year. The 50th year is the Yovel. Now, the Yovel goes beyond the Shemitah, because not only is agricultural work prohibited on the Yovel, but slaves go free, etc. Land goes back to its original owners. Now, we don't have Yovel today for a variety of reasons. Although we do have Shemitah, we do not observe the Jubilee year. And I sometimes think to myself how horrendously difficult it would be if the institution of the Jubilee year would come back. You know, a few years ago, the Native Americans were having a claim on Manhattan Island. They claimed that they sold it for an inadequate price, $24 of beads, in the 17th century, and therefore they'd like to get a share of the pie of Manhattan Island, which of course is now worth billions and billions and billions, maybe a trillion. I don't know. How much is Manhattan Island worth with all the buildings on it? Okay. You think they got a buck? Okay. You think they overpaid? Okay. But the thing is, in Yovel, imagine this. Let's say you have the Tel Aviv, you know, the shoreline in Tel Aviv, right? So some guy from the tribe of Zvulun, which was on the coast, we'll go back and say, hey, you know, those hotels belong to me because they're my ancestral inheritance. So the notion of somehow returning the land to the ancestral state would be enormously complicated, and that's why I'm very sure that Bimot HaMashiach, there will be a place for lawyers. I'm actually happy. You know, I'm an attorney as well, and I sometimes think, you know, will my profession be rendered useless, Bimot HaMashiach? But when I contemplate the institution of Yovel, I see that there'll be, have to be a lot of litigation regarding that. Yeah. Yeah, the reason is because Yovel, the Talmud has various interpretations, that Yovel depends on a majority of the Jewish population actually residing in the land of Israel, because it uses the word Yosheveha. Now, there was some discussion that actually we're not so far away, as you might think, from having a majority of the Jews in the world living in Israel. However, this also includes the lost 10 tribes, and of course, as you know, we are rediscovering all sorts of, right, there's all organizations that are rediscovering Jews in very unlikely places. What is the name of an organization that actually has a Washington office? Kulanu, that's correct. Kulanu is discovering, you know, a few million people here, and a few million people here, and a few million people here. So the truth of the matter is, in that sense, if these could be verified, that itself would defer the Yovel. In fact, that's why even when there was a Beit HaMikdash, even during the Second Temple period, Yovel was not practiced. And even in the First Temple period, from the time of the exile of the Northern Kingdom. So Yovel is not even connected to Beit HaMikdash as much as it is connected to most of the Jewish people living in the land of Israel. Now, there is one thing, just as an aside, there is in fact one ceremony that we still practice today that is a commemoration of the Yovel. I may have mentioned it last week. And that, ironically, is the blowing of the shofar, not on Rosh Hashanah, that's in the Torah, but the blowing of the shofar at the conclusion of Yom Kippur. Right? That's when, well, again, hopefully that shouldn't be a mad rush to get something to eat, but very often, you know, that's finally, you know, people can leave. And the thing is this, what does the shofar and Yom Kippur have to do with the Yovel? Because Yovel was an interesting institution. The year of Yovel was an atypical year. It did not begin on Rosh Hashanah. Yovel was a year that begins on Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur was the initiation of Yovel, and it was initiated by the blowing of the shofar every 50 years on Yom Kippur proper. Now, since we don't have the Yovel, and generally speaking, therefore, it would be improper to blow the shofar on Yom Kippur, we commemorate the Yom Kippur of Yovel by blowing the shofar right after Yom Kippur. Now, the question is, why are we so interested in commemorating Yovel? So the Maral offers a beautiful explanation. Because the shofar blowing on Yovel was a sign to the slaves that they have been freed. So we want to incorporate that ritual right after Yom Kippur to remind all of us that sin is a great enslaver of a person. And upon the completion of Yom Kippur, we have been freed from that which enslaves us. We are also the slaves, as it were. With the beckoning of that shofar, we can now attain our freedom. So it's a beautiful idea. So it's not just a technical borrowing of the Yovel motif, but it is designed, as it were, to remind us that the same meaning of Shiluach Avadim, the sending away of the slave, applies to the Yom Kippur service. Yom Kippur service in general. But going back to the Kabbalistic point I wanted to make, so the concept is you have 6 years and a Shemitah, 6 years and a Shemitah, 6 years and a Shemitah, till you get to the Yovel. So the Kabbalists posit there would actually be 7 cycles of 7 years. Meaning to say, the world goes through 6 years, has a Shabbat of 1,000 years, a redemption, but then the world progresses on a higher spiritual level. 7 years, and therefore the concept the Kabbalists took, which again, many would consider this heresy, but I'll share it with you, is that the Torah itself, these letters of the Torah, will assume different permutations and different forms as we enter a progressively more spiritualized existence. So for example, in this world, in this 6th millennia, the Torah has to say, don't kill, don't steal, don't cheat, don't commit adultery, because we're base and we're prone all of those sins. But after the 6,000 years and the 1,000 years of redemption, the Torah will come back. But it will be addressing a different human condition. It will be addressing a different personality, a different mindset, a more spiritualized. Again, we only understand this in the most theoretical way. And consequently, the letters of the Torah will form different words. And you understand? And progressively, this is called the doctrine of Tumurah. Tumurah means substitution, replacement. It's the same Torah, the same letters, but they could be rearranged. And it keeps on going on and on and on until after 49,000 years, we enter the Jubilee, which supposedly at this point the analogy breaks down, because the Jubilee is supposed to be finite, but at this point this is the eternal, you know, Olam Haba. The point, the reason I'm bringing this in is not so much because I'm going to Kabbalistic teaching, but to, again, reinforce this notion that the letters of the Torah have in the mystical tradition a meaning that is even independent of what those words communicate to us. And the Vilna Gaon, who, by the way, the Vilna Gaon is known as a great halakhic scholar, but he was also a great mystic in his own right, the Vilna Gaon writes, that is the meaning of Moshe writing the last eight verses, Bedema, the unbroken sequence, the primeval Torah, the Torah that is Eish Shechorah, black fire, Aleish Levana, on the white fire. Again, since I mentioned the Vilna Gaon and the notion of the letters of the Torah, it's very interesting that the Vilna Gaon says, this is even before computer technology, he says clearly every future event in any person's life can be found in the Torah, alluded to one way or the other. Of course, all of us know the dangers of retrospect. Again, I mean, scientifically, the issue of using a text as a prediction is very, very difficult to validate. And we certainly understand that, because number one, before it happens, you don't know what you're looking for. In other words, to say that Hitler is encoded in the Torah in the part dealing with Amalek, right, which they find. Well, 100 years ago, somebody looking in Amalek would not necessarily, you know, ascribe any significance to it, you know, hey, yud, tet, lamed, resh. On the other hand, after an event happens, you could find predictions in the New York Times. I mean, you could take Shakespeare or any text and come up with something. So it's very, very difficult to validate. But nevertheless, well before computer technology, it was stated that leka midi, this is Aramaic, leka midi delo remizi bioraita, there is nothing that is not alluded to in the Torah one way or the other. And the Vilna Gaon made an even more astounding claim. He said, there is nothing that cannot be alluded to in the very first word of the Torah. The Torah is of such infinite wisdom that the first word of the Torah, breshit, you can somehow figure out everything. So somebody threw out just a random question to the Vilna Gaon and said, hey, say everything's in that first word of breshit. Tell me where it says pidyon haben. Pidyon haben is a commandment that when you have a firstborn child, firstborn male child, you are supposed to give money to a kohen, to a priest, to redeem. It says, where do you see that in the word breshit? So the Vilna Gaon, without missing a beat, said, oh sure, breshit could be an acronym for the following. Let's see if I get this right. Bincha Rishon, Beis Resh. Bincha Rishon, Aleph Shin, Achar Shaloshim, after 30 yom days, Tifteh, you shall redeem. So breshit, right there. So, again, just immediately said that. So basically, once you get into all sorts of things, gematria, numerical equivalence, obviously words can have infinite meanings besides the simple meaning. And therefore this notion of the letters having significance even without the words is something that is very, very well accepted in the Kabbalistic tradition in particular. And occasionally the Talmud, which is not a mystical document, but the Talmud itself utilizes things like gematria, numerical equivalence, and the like. It does come out, in other words, that is a methodology that is accepted even in the mainstream rabbinic tradition. So as far as the Talmud was concerned, the Gemara was concerned, the whole book of Devarim was indeed written down by Moses, except perhaps for the last eight verses in which there is a discussion. But there is another theological problem here, and that is, in the traditional rabbinic belief, Moses functions like a recording secretary, meaning to say, Moses sits down, and God dictates, and Moses takes dictation. Now, let's look at this. I want to analyze this really from a traditional standpoint, because even the traditional standpoint is actually very difficult, and it's much more sophisticated than I think it's presented to our kids in school. The traditional standpoint says God gave the Torah to Moses on Mount Sinai. Right, that's the traditional belief. Think about that, and think about how really impossible that can be at face value, because the revelation at Sinai occurs in the middle of the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 20. Now, there are many events in the five books of Moses themselves that occurred after the revelation. We have the spies, we have the building of the tabernacle, we have the golden calf actually occurred before Moses came down, but certainly we have the story of the spies, we have the story of Korah, right? We have the story of the quail. All of those things are historical events that took place after the revelation of God on Mount Sinai. Now, are we to assume this way? Moses came down with this whole Torah, and Moses instructed the people, hey, in around 6 months, you are given the part of coming back from Israel and reporting negatively, and this is what's going to happen to you. And hey, Korah, be ready for that pit when it opens up. It's going to be pretty nasty, so be sure you have that extra protective, gear and everything. In other words, I understand that if one has a secular perspective, one says, well, everything is later, etc. But I want to analyze this even from the rabbinic perspective, which posits, as it says in Pirkei Avot, Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moses got the Torah from Mount Sinai. I think we need to think for a minute, what exactly does that mean if so much of the Torah, even as a narration, took place after the revelation at Sinai? The revelation of Sinai was essentially the first year after they left Egypt. It was 3 months after they left Egypt. The Torah, the five books of Moses, encompasses a 40-year period from the time of Yitziat Mitzrayim until Moses' death. So the answer is this. The answer is, from a traditional perspective, that the word Torah is not used in the sense of the literary composition that we call the five books of Moses, but Torah is in a much more limited and generic sense as the commandments of God, meaning to say God gave Moses at Sinai the code of law by which Jewish people are supposed to comport themselves. But the historical events, the narration, the book that we call the Torah, the Sefer Torah, was in fact, even under the most traditional Orthodox view in the Talmud, was not a finished work until the date of Moses' death. Again, whether Joshua wrote the last eight verses or Moses, he didn't write them until the day that he died. And in fact, there's a machloket in the Gemara, an argument in the Gemara, when did Moses write the various paragraphs of the Torah? Did he write them as they happened? Meaning, after the spies, he wrote down the spy story. After Korach, he wrote down the Korach story. And then at the end of his life, he simply arranged them in the proper order. Or was there no Sefer Torah at all until the 40th year of the desert? Okay, the point I want to make is, nobody is of the position that Moses came down from Mount Sinai with a scroll of the law. He came down with tablets. The tablets had the Ten Commandments on them. And then he smashed them and went up again and came down with the second Ten Commandments. But nobody says, and that's why you never see a picture like that, right? Nobody says he came down with the Sefer Torah. That would have been impossible because the stuff didn't happen yet. And Moses didn't write a script for people to memorize and then behave like automatons who are simply mastering a part. So therefore, it's important to, I think, I'm not sure how much you explained this to children, but the concept of Moshe kibel Torah miSinai, Torah in that statement does not refer to the book that we know of as the five books of Moses or the Sefer Torah. It refers to the commandments and the laws and etc. But the narration occurs later. In fact, I even have to qualify that further, because it's fairly clear that even all of the commandments were not given to Moses at that time, because many commandments were elicited as a result of the historical occasions themselves. For example, after the death of Nadav and Avihu, Aaron's two children, there were commandments that a Kohen should not drink wine when he goes into the sanctuary. But that was given as a result of that event. But then we have to say, well, most of the commandments were given to Moses at that time. Okay, so it clearly does not include the narration, except, of course, maybe from Bereishit up until that point. That may have been included. In other words, Moshe may have had a truncated Sefer Torah comprising Genesis and half of Exodus. But the rest of the stuff was written later. Later, and the machloket in the Gemara, the argument in the Gemara, is either as events unfolded or at the very end. I don't know. Again, the tradition does teach that Moses wrote them. Yes, yes. That's not in dispute. All I'm saying is it was not at Mount Sinai. It was in the course of the desert experience. Yeah. Yes. Once again, I think that we have to de-emphasize the Sinai, meaning some of it was given. The point is that the traditional belief is certainly that God communicated oral law along with written law, but it may not have been at Sinai. It may have been in the course of the 40 years of the desert wandering. Sinai essentially is the initiation of revelation, but it's not its terminus point. That's right.
And so trope, which is added to, not part of the original text, nonetheless is a written commemoration of the oral nature of Torah. So the Torah is an oral document.
That's right. Yeah, that's a very good point. The concept of the oral law, which is really a subject for a whole other discussion, but obviously the concept that God gave Moses, whether it's at Sinai or over 40 years, that's almost a peripheral point, that with the written text of the Torah came a supplementary oral tradition that was preserved for thousands of years in primarily an oral form until around the Second Temple period, when there was a fear of forgetting because of persecution, when it began to be committed in writing and things like the Mishnah and the Gemara and the like. Now, people sometimes say, well, how can an oral tradition be preserved for thousands of years? The truth of the matter is, the Iliad and the Odyssey are from a time in Greece which was pre-literate or pre-written language. And indeed, Native American tribes, of course there are fewer and fewer that preserve this, preserve huge sagas and epics which take, 3 weeks to recite, and there is a concept of transmission. We have gotten out of the habit of memorizing large quantities of information because we can either go to a library and I can go to the internet and get it off the net right away. So our memory facility has atrophied perhaps a little bit. But nevertheless, this concept of preserving huge amounts of information in the memory was well known in ancient cultures. But I just want to finish the point. And as you said, why is there this supplementary oral tradition? Because there is a concept that the visual sense, which takes in the written word, only comprehends a partial dimension of the reality. There is an aspect of hearing, and there's also an aspect of human interaction. In fact, I've even heard it said, as a partial criticism, that, now in America we are very fortunate that virtually all the great works of Jewish religious literature are in translation. So now it's wonderful. You could read Talmud, you could read Maimonides, you could read Kabbalah even. But some have said there is a downside to the accessibility of the word in translation, and that is it destroys the need to a human interaction, to have a human teacher. It doesn't destroy the need, but it gives people the impression that they don't have that need. And part of the notion of keeping it oral meant you couldn't go to the library and pull out the book. You had to go to a master who would initiate you. So what you're saying is very true.
For those who are interested in this topic, as distinct from the study of the farm, there's a very well-known scholar, Francis Lee, who's written on Christian Kabbalah and John Dee and Giordano Bruno and people like that, but he's also written a fascinating text called The Art of Memory. It's not about how to memorize things, it's about the history of a fascinating memory technology that existed up until more or less the time of printing press,
Well, that's interesting.
Right.
And in fact, you read that the Talmud often recounts where somebody heard a teaching from his teacher, he would recite it 40 or 50 times until it would be in his pocket. That was the expression. There was this notion of really learning. And in fact, the indication was that in Talmudic times, prior to the committing of the oral law into writing, there were professional memorizers who served the function of libraries, essentially. Meaning to say, there were those scholars who were the analytic thinkers, and then they would have these memorizers. And we often find that the memorizer would recite something, the analytic thinker would say, that has to be wrong because that doesn't fit something else. Let's correct the memory bank, so to speak. So you actually had, you know, the thinker and the, like, you know, like a reader of a book, essentially, who would kind of recite, and the analytic thinker would or qualify as that needed to be so. So you had human libraries, essentially, at that point. But it's very, very interesting. Again, it's beyond the topic, but I think it's important anyway, that it was actually part of the halakha that the oral traditions were not allowed to be reduced to writing. It wasn't just a convention. There was really a specific halakhic ruling. Devarim she'bal peh, those portions of the Torah, of the halakha, that were not committed to writing, you are not permitted to write them down. Later, it became mutar, as it were, because there was a real fear that the Torah would be forgotten. When I say Torah, I mean not the five books of Moses, I mean the whole tradition and understanding, and the halakha would be forgotten. And they relied on a verse in Psalms that says, Eit lasot l'ashem, when it is time to stand up for God, heferu torasecha, one can annul the Torah. In other words, one can violate the halakha in the short term in order to secure the long-term survival of the Jewish tradition and the halakha. Now, when you apply that itself is a very interesting and controversial topic, but it does suggest the notion, bitula zehu kiyuma, that sometimes annulling something is the way that you sustain it and keep it alive. But again, who makes that judgment? I'm not going to touch that question right now. Okay, so that's what I want you to clarify a little bit. This concept of Torah mi-Sinai does not mean the five books of Moses mi-Sinai. It means the mitzvot mi-Sinai, but the narrative came over the 40 years. Nevertheless, we do have to differentiate between Torah mi-Sinai and Torah min ha-Shamayim. These are two phrases that are used interchangeably, but they are different. Torah mi-Sinai, which is a claim that God gave the Torah to Moses on Mount Sinai, is not true in a literal sense. It refers to the commandments, it does not refer to the five books of Moses. Torah min ha-Shamayim, however, Shamayim is heaven, God, that the Torah comes from God, is a divine work, that certainly is a cornerstone of traditional belief. Again, whatever your beliefs are, that's a separate matter. I'm not here to convince anyone. I'm just here to articulate what the traditional standard was in the Talmud when it talks about Torah min ha-Shamayim, and whether the Torah was given at Sinai or given over 40 years, it clearly was considered to be the product of God. And in that sense, Moses is traditionally perceived as being a secretary. He is taking down the dictation that God is giving him. Now, where that creates a problem from a traditional standpoint is the book of Devarim does not fit that particular paradigm. Because in the book of Devarim, it appears to be the voice of Moses himself talking. These are Moses' words. In other words, when it says in the Torah, for example, V'yedaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor, God spoke to Moses saying, so Moses is then quoting God. Moses said, God told me to tell you A, B, C, and D. But the book of Devarim is not, and God spoke to Moses. The book of Devarim is, Moses is speaking. So the question is, how do you understand? And in fact, the Talmud actually makes this point in a different context. It makes the point that the whole Torah are the words of God, but the book of Devarim are the words of Moses. An amazing thing. And in fact, it even makes the point how Moses gives us a tougher deal than God. If you remember, let me just draw the example here. There is, at the end of Leviticus, a part of the Torah that is called the Tochacha. The tokacha is that part of the Torah that is the rebuke. It is the awful curses that can befall a nation when they reject God. Right? This will happen, that will happen, that will happen, etc. There is also a tokacha at the end of Deuteronomy. In fact, we're going to read it this coming Shabbat. Yisavah is a tokacha. The Gemara comments, the tokacha in Vayikra, at the end of Leviticus, are God's words. The tokacha at the end of Devarim are Moses' words. And it points out in a number of respects how the tokacha in Devarim is tougher on the Jewish people than is the tokacha in Vayikra. And the Talmud says, because when God talks, God has mercy. When human beings talk and criticize, they often do so relentlessly without mercy. So the Talmud actually says, the book of Devarim are Moses' words, they're not God's words. So the question then becomes, from a traditional theological standpoint, well, wait a second here. The whole Torah, good. Torah Misinai, I said, you don't have to accept as a literal statement. Torah Min HaShamayim, though, is a cornerstone. And yet we see the book of Devarim are not God's words anymore. They are Moses' own words. God did not tell Moses, in other words, ahead of time, what to say. Moses is not reading from a script. Moses, these are his own spontaneous words. So here, the clearest exposition of how you reconcile these theological postulates is found in the writings of the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel, as you know, is a very interesting figure. The Abarbanel, Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, was the finance minister for Ferdinand and Isabella during the, 1492, two things happened. The expulsion of the Jews from Spain and Columbus's voyage, and it happened, close together. And the Abarbanel was the only Jew who was given specific dispensation that he could remain in Spain without converting to Christianity, simply because the monarchy needed his royal talents. But he, of course, refused to take advantage of that. And he went into exile with his brothers and sisters. And the Abarbanel then entered really a very, very fertile phase of his spiritual career. He went to Portugal, then he went to Italy, and he composed his great biblical commentaries. It's very interesting, just as a total aside, one of the very rare expositions of Jewish political theory that you'll find is found in the writings of the Abarbanel. You know, one of the questions that classical biblical commentaries deal with is, we read in Torah a few weeks ago that there's a mitzvah to have a king. Having a melech is one of the mitzvot, and yet we find in the book of Samuel, when the Jewish people finally get around to asking for a king, Samuel goes into a whole diatribe, really, how evil this is, and God should be your king, you don't ask for a flesh and blood king, and he criticizes them. And he says, the king will do this and that to you, will take your sons and enslave your daughters and confiscate your property. There'll be taxes and mandatory service and the like. And God seems to side with Samuel. Remember, Samuel says, and if I'm right, there ought to be thunder and lightning coming from the sky. And thunder and lightning comes from the sky. And Shmuel tells them, you see, I told you, you are wrong in asking for a melech. So all of the commentaries have a lot of difficulty, as it were, how to reconcile Deuteronomy, which seems to call for a king, with Samuel, who condemns it. And when we get to that, we'll discuss it in more length. I just want to anticipate a little bit by giving the Abarbanel's approach. The Abarbanel's approach is totally against the mainstream of all other rabbinic tradition. The Abarbanel says, yeah, a king is no good. Kings are lousy. And when the Torah says you should have a king, it is not a commandment. It says, if you ask for one, you can have it, but it's not a good thing. He totally says, and he contrasts vividly a Republican state, I don't mean Newt Gingrich Republican, a Republic, I mean a representative democracy where you have representatives, and he vividly contrasts it with the excesses of the monarchy. He says, hey, I came from Spain, and I lived under a monarchy, and I saw how oppressive and how arbitrary it is, but now I come to the wonderful Italian city-states, and he talks about Florence and Genoa and Milan and Venice, which had rotating city councils, not city, they were like city-states, and he talked about separation of powers, and he talked about term limits, and the Abarbanel actually says that when people know they are in power at the will of the electorate, and they have to stand re-election, they are accountable for what they do, and they're not going to abuse their powers. The Abarbanel actually has a very interesting brief in support of representation. term limits and separation of powers, because he says from his own vantage point, monarchies are corrupting, and as Lord Acton said many years later, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So it's a very interesting thing. The Reverend Ellis was a very big advocate. Of course, this was in the 15th century of what would later become, let's say, the hallmarks of, let's say, the United States system or government of that nature. But be it as it may, going back to what I wanted to quote the Abravanel for, the Abravanel offers, I think, a very, very, from a traditional standpoint, a very, very satisfying understanding within the framework of tradition. How do you say, on one hand, the whole Torah is God's document, and yet the Book of Devarim are Moses' words? And the Abravanel differentiates between the spoken word and the written word. Again, it's a very self-evident distinction. Obviously, nobody in the Torah is speaking from a script. The Torah records many, many words of people who talked on their own volition. Paro, when Paro talks to Moses, or the king of Sodom, or whatever it is, these are not God's words in the sense that God told them what to say. They said it first. When we say the Torah are God's words, we just mean that God dictated to Moses what of that past should be memorialized and in what form. Meaning to say, God is indeed the dictator of the Torah, but God is drawing on the experiences and the words that other people said. So the Book of Devarim is the same way. The spoken word was Moses' word. God did not tell Moses, "So you shall say to the Jewish people." These are Moses' own words. But Moses may have said many words, many more words. It was God, through the process of dictation, that told Moses, "Hey Moses, these are your words that I am authorizing you to write down in the Torah to become part of the permanent repository." This is a very, an eminently logical distinction, if you think about it, that the Torah are not God's words in the oral sense, but they are God's words in the dictated sense. Because Moses made these speeches on his own. He didn't clear them with God, so to speak. God didn't tell Moses, "You shall say this." These are Moses' own spontaneous utterings. But God sought to memorialize them by telling Moses, "What of your utterings shall we include and what not?" And in that sense, therefore, the notion of Moshe mipi atzmo, that these are Moses' own words, is fully consistent with the notion of Torah min haShamayim, that every word of the Torah was inscribed at the instigation of God. Again, as I say, I mean, obviously you see this in smaller segments. Paro's words, Korach's words, they're not God's words ahead of time, but they're the portion of the past that God said should be realized in the Torah. There are many words of Moses that we don't have. In point of fact, in the apocryphal literature, again, I mean, we can hardly make the claim that they are Moses' words, but there are apocryphal works called The Last Words of Moses, etc. In other words, there was a recognition that there's a lot of stuff that could have been said that was not included in the canon. I'm sorry, was there a hand up? What that would indicate is that from Deuteronomy one could try to compose a portrait of the personality of Moses more accurately than when he is simply being a conduit for somebody else's sentiment. The Talmud already showed us, in a limited sense, that when human beings speak through their own agenda, there's a certain fierceness and lack of compassion that doesn't exist when one is operating through the divine. So this is the Abravanel. If you're interested, I quoted two passages in the Abravanel. The first passage, which is not relevant here, about political theory, can be found in his commentary to Samuel 1, chapter 9. That's the chapter in the book of Samuel dealing with the monarchy. And the second point I made about the difference between the writing of the Torah and the oral nature of the Torah, that could be found in his introduction to the book of Deuteronomy, where he deals with this particular question. The Vilna Gaon says it in a slightly different way. I think fundamentally it's the same idea, but he expresses it in a mystical terminology. But I think if you pierce away the mystic veil, I think it boils down to the same thing. And that is, he says that in the four books of Moses, Shekhinah midaberet mitoch throno shel Moshe. Moses is speaking, but it is the voice of God that comes out. In other words, you don't hear Moses' voice, you hear God's voice. The book of Devarim, Moshe Medaber Biad Atzmo, you hear Moses' voice. Now the Vilna Gaon seems to say that there's actually a different physical voice that you hear. In other words, in one case you hear God's voice, one case you hear Moses' voice. But again, I think that metaphorically it boils down to the same thing, and that is that in one case Moses is a conduit for the message that God has given him. In the other case, these are Moses' own sentiments, which God sought to memorialize and honor by incorporating within the Torah itself. Yeah. Right. That's why he uses the Shekhinah idea. Yeah, well, that could be, of course, the Shekhinah is actually the feminine element of God, as well as, you know. Yeah. Okay, well, anyway, but that's just some basic. Now, again, as I say, these problems are real problems. How you seek to resolve them will depend on your theological orientation, but it is clear that the Book of Devarim is a first-person document primarily, while the most of the Torah is narrated in the third person. And that itself gives you cause to try to understand the distinction. The only problem we have with the Abarbanel is the following. If the book of Devarim is Moses himself initiating communication, then how do you explain the plethora of new commandments in Devarim? I mean, certainly Moses didn't make up a commandment. In other words, when you have mitzvot that only appear in the book of Deuteronomy, and do not appear in the other books, and you don't have Yidaber Hashem El Moshe Leimor, and the Lord spoke to Moses, then are you forced, maybe this doesn't bother some people again, but are you forced to the conclusion that some of this stuff Moses just thought of and God validated ex post facto? That would be a difficult position, and one would assume. Again, Nachmanides says, listen, Nachmanides kind of puts in as a an omission, anytime Moses gives us a commandment which is not prefaced by Hashem giving him the commandment, it is to be understood that there was a preceding commandment to give the commandment. Once again, there are some curious omissions here. How come for so many commandments it is prefaced by God giving Moses the commandment, and some of them are not prefaced that way? We read a whole bunch of commandments last week. In fact, last week's parsha has more mitzvot than any other parsha in the whole Torah, over 55 mitzvot. That's a large amount. And none of them are prefaced with, and God spoke to Moses. Moses just gives these commandments. So the question becomes, you know, where was the authority for that? Yeah. Yes. I think you're right, and this gets us into yet another subtlety, because there's so many distinctions you can make here, and that is, there is a distinction between when Moses was given the rules and when Moses communicated them and elaborated them and explained them and applied them. It could very well be that Moses didn't feel like giving people information about how to get a divorce while he was alive, because, no, actually, Nachmanides suggests this, because he figures, you know, they don't need to know. Let them work it out. He realizes, in fact, Nachmanides actually says, that's really the thesis. Moses, remember, is talking to a new generation. The old generation of the desert has died out. Moses is going to die very shortly. These are new people. And some of the stuff that Moses could have kept close to his chest, as it were, for while he was alive. Divorce is a good example. I don't need to divorce. I'll handle it. Actually, I shouldn't say Moshe would handle it. As you know, the great marriage counselor in the tradition during the desert was Aaron. Aharon is called in Pirkei Avot, Ohev Shalom, the lover of peace, Rodef Shalom, the pursuer of peace. If you remember, one of Aaron's great fortes was to try to bring peace, bring shalom between husband and wife, that if spouses were fighting, he would go over to one spouse and say, you know, your other spouse really wants to make up, they feel so bad, and he would, you know, he would go to both of them, and then they would embrace, and everybody would be happy. So it could very well be that things like a get, you know, Moshe didn't bother telling people that. So there is another distinction, and that is the distinction between when God told Moses and when Moses told Bnei Yisrael. Because again, it's very, very clear, even a casual perusal of the Torah indicates that the Jewish people got their commandments in dribs and drabs. They didn't get everything all at once. They got things over a gradual period. So we have to differentiate, therefore, Torah Misinai does not include the narrative, and Torah Misinai does not even include when the Jewish people got the mitzvot. It refers to when Moses got the mitzvot at various times. Okay, so that's kind of just a very, very brief perspective of the book of Devarim. Obviously, we can't read pasuk by pasuk, but what I want to do right now, because these are very, very difficult psukim, I just want to look at the first five verses of the book of Deuteronomy. The first five verses of the book of Deuteronomy are a superscription. They indicate the time and the place of this book. But Moses' discourse, the quotation marks, so to speak, do not begin until verse 6. Okay? Verses 1 through 5 are still the omniscient voice of the narrator. Okay? So let's just look at these verses and see if we can make some basic sense of them. Eila hadvarim, these are the words, Asher diber Moshe el kol Yisrael, that Moses spoke to all of Israel. Rashi makes the definite point that Moses was very insistent that everybody show up at the time, because these are his last words and he wants them to penetrate the heart of everybody. Kol Yisrael again. Well, again, if you think about this logistically, how many people are kol Yisrael? Well, we are given only a limited number. We are given the numbers of the males between the ages of 20 and 60, and that number is given as 603,000. Now, Kol Yisrael certainly includes all the women and the children and the young people and old people as well. So we might be dealing with a population of several million, and there's no public address system. But Moses insists on addressing everybody. Now, where was he talking to them? The Eber HaYarden, the other side of the Jordan. We always know that the other side, although that's the side that they're on, you might as well say the other side is Israel, but the other side is always the east bank, because the west bank of the Jordan is, of course, the land of Israel. And the Torah is emphasizing once again that Moses can only be Eber HaYarden. Moses cannot cross. Again, one should really understand the depth of this type of tragedy, where you have the person who took them out of Egypt, who did so much, and yet the final ability to enter Eretz Yisrael is denied to him. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, I understand that. That's a good question. I think the answer is that from the perspective of Moshe, or the narrator, even when you're on the other side, it's still the other side. Meaning to say, right, even before you cross west, that's home, and this is the other side. Right, that's a very interesting point, that we call east bank of the Jordan the other side, even when you're there, and you're not in the other place yet. But that is the other side. That's the other, not just as we say, going to Israel is Aliyah, going up, leaving Israel, Yeridah, going down, and it makes no difference if you're going to higher elevations or lower elevations. It's a spiritual thing. Now we know, of course, remember, Eber HaYarden actually, though, does have some of the sanctity, because remember, it was the land that was conquered. Actually, how much we'll say this here, it was conquered from the Amorite kingdoms, and it was given to the 2.5 tribes, Reuven, Gad, and half of the tribe of Manasseh. Remember, they had a lot of flocks, and this is very fertile land, and they asked Moses if they could settle there, and Moses was very incensed, because Moses said, how dare you basically send your brethren to war, and you want to settle here, and they have to make a promise that we will fight with our brethren, but this is where we want to settle. So this is Eber HaYarden. Okay, so far so good. Obviously, this makes perfect sense. Moses is addressing the people and the east bank of the Jordan. By the way, you think of this very day that the east bank of the Jordan is an extraordinarily fertile land. If you go through the Jordan Valley, you'll notice that on the Jordanian side of the Jordan Valley is very, very lush and green, and on the Israeli side it tends to be not so much. Now, of course, part of that is because they have security zones and they have sand there, sand to detect terrorists and footprints. So, you know, I'm not sure what it would come out if they would try to cultivate it. But it is interesting that at least on superficial view, it confirms the Torah's description that the east bank, for whatever reason, tended to be more fertile, which is a very interesting departure from the normal pattern of Eretz Yisrael, where generally speaking, that is the fertile part, and a lot of the surrounding areas, are not. By the way, again, when we talk about the fertility of the land, I just can't help remarking that the Talmud relates, and this is an amazing fact, and it seems to be true, that the land of Israel does not yield its bounty except to the Jewish people. Meaning to say, the land itself shuts down when the Jews aren't there. Which is, again, a historical fact that any other people that inhabited the land of Israel were not able to get anything out of it significantly. Mark Twain remarked in the 19th century, when he saw the desolation of the land, he says he doesn't know why anybody would choose this land as a chosen land. There's nothing there. It's barren, it's desolate, it's stony. And now, of course, one could say, well, that's because the Jews invested and they're hard workers and they're creative and they're brilliant and everything else. But in a spiritual sense, the Talmud says, the land of Israel is like a woman who only gives... pinpoints a lot of places. Bamidbar, the desert. Okay, I guess everything is a desert, although Eber HaYarden is not a desert, it's a very fertile plain. Be'arava, Arava is a coastal plain. What coastal plain are we talking about, though? I mean, the term Arava, for example, in the book of Joshua, is used for the Mediterranean coasts. But here, you know, you don't call the bank of a river, you don't call that the Arava, commonly. Mul Suf, Mul is adjacent. Adjacent to Suf, what is Suf? Well, Suf sounds like Yam Suf, Red Sea, but what are they doing there? Bein Paran and Bein Tophel, between Paran and Tophel, two other places which are otherwise not identified, and Lavan and Chatzeros, Vidi Zahav. Now, part of the problem is the following. Part of the problem is that the simple meaning, which I think is reflected in translation, is that Moses gave his speeches in a lot of different places. Meaning the book of Devarim was not said in one place, but as they're moving place, he'll give a speech here, a speech here, a speech here, a speech here. That might make sense, but the reason why that is a difficult interpretation is, number one, the identification of these places isn't clear. And by that I mean, I don't just mean that in contemporary geography we can't identify them. I mean, that's an endemic problem. But I mean this. At the end of the book of Numbers, we are given a complete itinerary of every place the Jewish people stopped until they got to the plains of Moab. And a lot of these places, Lavan, Dizahav, are not on that itinerary. Some of them are, Chatzeros, some of those places are. But some of these places don't match that list. So it's difficult to see that this would have been a list of places. Moreover, it is very clear that the book of Devarim was not set over a long time, because if you look at verse 3, it is given a date. The first day of the 11th month of the year. Right, that's the first day of the 11th month of the year, the 40th year of the wandering in the desert. Now, let's figure out what month that is. Keep in mind that the entire five books of Moses, except perhaps in the story of the flood, the months are always counted not from Tishrei, Rosh Hashanah. In fact, as far as the Torah is concerned, you will not even see anywhere in the Torah, I mean, it does say that on the first day of the seventh month, which is Tishrei, you should celebrate a holiday, but it doesn't call it Rosh Hashanah at all. you would not even, in fact, you don't even know what it's supposed to celebrate whatsoever. It's not recorded. It's a very enigmatic holiday. But you know that all months are counted not from Tishrei, but you know they're counted from Nisan. Right? HaChodesh HaRishon, the first month is Nisan. Chodesh HaSheni is Iyar. Chodesh HaShlishi is Sivan. Tishrei is not described as Chodesh HaRishon in the Torah. Tishrei is HaChodesh HaShvi'i. Right? Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, Tishrei. Seventh month. So, what month is the 11th month? Shvat. Moses gave his discourse Rosh Chodesh Shvat. Now, according to tradition, when did Moshe die? The 7th of Adar. So, according to tradition, Adar is the 12th month. According to tradition, this is a discourse, or at least the beginning is a discourse that is given 1 month and 1 week before his death. So it's unlikely that they traveled all of these stops in 1 month, etc. Here, 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 here. So it's very difficult to interpret these different place names as places. So of course, again, you can differentiate because you could divide the superscription this way. The first verse is telling us where he gave all his different talks. Then when it says he gave on Rosh Chodesh Shvat, that's referring to the particular talk that then follows. In other words, there is the general superscription and then there's the particular. You could learn it that way. But let me share with you Rashi's comment. Rashi says, because of all of these questions, actually it's a Midrashic teaching, Rashi says that these various locations are not to be understood in a geographical sense. They are to be understood in a homiletical sense. Meaning to say, the geography is one place, Eber HaYarden and Arvot Moab, the plains of Moab. Right, the Moab plains. But the subject matter concerns Midbar, Arava, Suf, Paran, Tophel, Lavan, Chatzerot, Dizahar. What do we mean? How do we mean that? So Rashi explains that Moshe's goal here is to give people what is called Tochacha. Tochacha literally is translated as rebuke or chastisement. Now we're going to discuss that to the modern ear, this has a very negative connotation. I don't want to be rebuked. I don't want to be abused. I don't want to be chastised. I don't want to be criticized. The truth of the matter is, the shorish of tochacha, which is the same word we use for those awesome curses in the book of Leviticus, is lahochiach, which really means to demonstrate or to clarify. So tochacha is not so much that I'm dumping on you, but it's to clarify what your priority should be in life. And to remind people to try to avoid the mistakes in the past of either themselves or their predecessors that led to so much disappointment and so much frustration. There is nothing inconsistent, and indeed, this is the way it should be, between tochacha and love. And in fact, the Talmud talks about the ideal mochiach, the ideal chastiser, should be one that is motivated out of love and concern. In fact, there's a whole discussion where one of the rabbis of the Talmud was complaining that nobody knows how to take criticism today. And Rabbi Akiva responded, that's because nobody knows how to give it. Meaning to say that if people feel that they are dumped upon and criticized and looked down upon, they do not open up. But if they feel that someone genuinely cares about them and loves them and is concerned for their welfare, then they will be responsive to whatever demands or whatever points need to be corrected, because there's fundamentally a connection there. I'm sorry, did you want to say something? In fact, you're 100% correct. That's another comment that Rashi makes after the one. Rashi makes the point that the best time to give tochacha is right before you die, because you never know exactly. But Moses, you know, knew that his end was coming, and the concept is Rashi gives two reasons. One reason is because if you don't do it then, when, you better try to do it then. But the other point is that people are more receptive. People will pay attention, they will listen, they will see that it's how important it is, as opposed to the things you tell people, you know, years before, they forget, they ignore, they think there's more time. So the notion, which is why, as you know, there's an old Jewish tradition, they even give courses on this, of the old ethical will. I'm sure you've heard of that. That is not just writing a will about what happens to your money, but leaving some type of message for your children regarding what you want for them in a spiritual sense. And now we have all sorts of technologies, right? We have videotapes. And I would imagine, I mean, I've never had that experience firsthand, but I would imagine that having a videotape of someone that left you and having them talk directly to you is an extremely powerful experience. It's literally a message from beyond the grave. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's what I'm gonna do now. So look at the way Rashi interprets this. This is a very beautiful midrash. Bamidbar, starting from that word in verse 1, we're no longer talking about where Moses spoke, but Ba means regarding. He spoke regarding all of the sins that the Jewish people committed in the desert experience. So Bamidbar is reminding them of their Aveirot in the Midbar. Ba'arava refers to the sin that was committed in the plains of Moab. That was actually very recent. At the end of the book of Bamidbar, if you remember, after Bilam was hired to curse them, and Bilam was not successful, because every time he tried to curse them, God changed the bracha, the klala rather, the curse, to a blessing. So Bilam, the ever resourceful perpetrator of evil, came up with a better idea. He says, listen, I can't really curse them, that's not working, but let's entice them to commit sins of idolatry and promiscuous sex. Remember, this was the sin. Baal Peor is an idol, was a Moabite god, and the daughters of Moab dressed up and they enticed the Jewish people in illicit sexuality and to worship Baal Peor. And therefore, Arava is reminded, and by the way, that was a sin of this new generation, this is not the old generation, this just happened a short while ago. So Arava reminds them of Baal Peor. Mul Suf reminds them of their rebelliousness at the Red Sea 40 years before. Paran is where the spies were sent out from. They were sent out from Midbar Paran. Now Tophel, there is no place name of Tophel whatsoever. Let me see how Rashi brings that. Rashi says, yes, Tophel, okay, is an allegorical meaning here. When something is tafel, tafel with a taf, that means it is tasteless. And this is an allusion to the complaints they had about the manna, about the man, that it was tasteless and inconsequential. So he's reminding them of that. Lavan, let me find that. Yeah, that's a little difficult. Rashi combines tofel and lavan are one. Tofel is the mun was tasteless and it had a white color. It didn't have a bright, vivid color. So it's the mana complaints. Chatzerot was a city where the Korach rebellion took place. That reminds him of Korach. And Dizahav is the abundance of gold, is a reminder of the golden calf. So you see, again, of course, the problem is that this is a totally non-chronological sequence of sin. It kind of mixes all sorts of things together. But the point of the Midrash is to indicate that this is not a statement of where Moses gave his talk, but this is a listing of the subject matters of his talk. However, the commentaries in the Midrash make another subtlety, and they say the following. They say that, so why does the Torah address it as a code? You know, why doesn't it, you know, I mean, later on we have explicit statements regarding this and that. They say that Moses initially referred to their Aveirot in a kind of a code language because he didn't want them to be publicly humiliated. It was kind of, you know what I'm talking about. In other words, as if he would tell them, my talk today is about Midbar, Arava, Suf, Paran, Tophel, Lavan, Chatzerot, and Dizahav. I hope you understand what it is I'm about to say. In other words, this is part of the encoding that Moses himself used to kind of not shock people, but warn people that there's going to be some difficult issues we have to discuss. It's a way of preparing a person to confront some tough issues. Okay, so that's the Midrashic explanation. Again, other commentaries, and I think modern interpretations, by and large, look at these as literal placements, and they simply refer to the fact that Moses gave his discourses in a variety of places. As I say, interpretively, there's some difficulties with that, because Lavan and Tophel, for example, are non-existent places, as far as we know from anywhere else, in the Torah. Okay, now let's look at Pasuk Bet, which, I'm sorry. Well, that's hard to say. You're correct in noting that sometimes symbols and codes are only understood by some people. One would have assumed perhaps they would have been the spiritually elites. And maybe Moses' point is that I hold the leadership accountable for those failings, and they should be the first ones who absorb this message. That might be it as well. It's a good point. Yeah.
I think a lot of things would have to be understood in the same way that we use shorthand, like a sin of water day, and nobody needs to have that explicated. There doesn't have to be a spiritual elite to understand what it might be.
Because this was part of their recent experience. Yeah.
Right. Like
yeah.
One single word.
Right. That's a good point. In other words, the associations that we have to laboriously reconstruct doesn't necessarily, express what those things meant to them. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Okay, that's right. Like the Passover Seder, where you kind of use questions to stimulate conversation. I think that's a good point. Keep in mind, though, it's not many generations. Remember that the new generation, the whole Torah, from the Exodus to the end of the Torah is 40 years. I mean, you have the book of Genesis that spans hundreds of years, thousands of years, but from Shemot, from Yitziat Mitzrayim till here is only 40 years. So, Okay, now let's look at the next verse. All right, so the first verse tells us something about place, but then we're given another place description, which doesn't seem to fit in that well either. It says, Achad Asar Yom Mechorev Derech Har Seir Ad Kadesh Barnea. This is a very confusing verse. Literally it means, it is an 11-day, and journey is an elliptical word that should be supplied, it is an 11-day journey from Chorev. Now Chorev, as we know, is one of the names for Mount Sinai. Har Sinai is called Har Chorev. So there's an 11-day journey from Chorev, Derech Har Seir, going through the Seir mountain lands. That's essentially going south. Again, Seir is northern. It's directly north of Saudi Arabia. It's south of the Dead Sea. And Seir was the land, the ancestral land that was given to Esau, right? Esau the Seir, the hairy one. Again, there's an argument, actually. Why is Seir called Seir? Some say because it was the land of Esau, who is described as the hairy person. Modern scholars translate Seir, which also comes from hairy, because it was a heavily forested region, although that's much less so today. And Seir could be used for mountainous forest land. Although, as I would say, you nary see a trace of that today. But be it as it may, the Chumash makes a statement here, which seems to be out of left field. What's the relevance of it? It is an 11-day journey from Mount Sinai through the Seir Highlands till you reach the city of Kadesh Barnea. Well, I would say that's wonderful, but they're not in Kadesh Barnea. They're in Arvot Moab. Meaning to say, it's like I'd be standing here talking to you here in Rockville, and I would say, I'm going to give you an amusar, I'm going to give you chastisement and tochacha, and I want to remind you that it is a one-day journey between Baltimore and Randallstown if you go by foot. But it's not relevant to anything because they're not even there anyway. In other words, this is a piece of information that it is an 11-day journey from Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. So Rashi once again says that midrashically we understand this as part of a subtle rebuke that Moses is giving Bnei Yisrael in this superscription. And that is, Kadesh Barnea is a town that will live in infamy, as was said about the bombing of Pearl Harbor, because Kadesh Barnea was the town from which the Meraglim were sent. The Meraglim were actually sent, the spies were sent from Kadesh Barnea. And Moses is making the point, as it were, in kind of reminiscing, you know, when you left Mount Sinai and you came to Kadesh Barnea, that would have been an 11-day journey by foot, he says. And yet, he says, you covered it in 3 days. That's not in the verse, but kind of reminding me, you know, how long does it take to go from A to B? It takes 11 days. But if you go back in the Chumash, we see that they reached, Rashi proves it through in a very intricate calculation, that they got from Har Sinai to Kadesh Barnea in a trip of 3 days. So, but then of course things fell apart because from Kadesh Barnea another 38 years. So in other words, what God is telling the Jewish people, or Moses is telling the Jewish people, is that God was very eager to bring you into the land of Israel very quickly. You went faster than normal. So how do you explain the fact that you then have been wandering around in one place or a few places for 38 years? It got to be because of the Aveirot of not having faith. And therefore, once again, it's a very subtle tokacha. It's a subtlety of reminding people that God is very eager to bring you into the land of Israel. So be sure you don't mess up the opportunity the second time. Okay, so, because otherwise it's a difficult verse to interpret. It's an 11-day journey from point A to point B, but Moshe is not at point B here. Moshe is in the plains of Moab. He's not in Kadesh Barnea. I just want to think about here. Yes. Chorev, in a literal sense, just means to be dry and desolate. Chorev, for example, it says by the Mabul, by the flood. After the floods, after Noach waited in the ark for a long time, the land was chorev, or techarav ha'aretz. Chorev, again, it's all related even the word for destruction, chorban. Chorev is dry, desolate, not wet, doesn't have moisture. And it goes back to the fact that God deliberately picked a desolate, dry mountain to give to the Torah. You know the famous Midrash that all of the mountains were fighting to get the Torah, and God chose the lowest desolate mountain of Sinai as a symbol of humility and lack of pretension, because God says that is where my Torah shall reside. Okay. In other words, you're asking, is Chorev related to Cherev? I think so, in an etymological sense, because the sword was the instrument by which people became dispossessed of their property, of their person, of their family, of even their life. So it is related to being dried out. Being dried out basically means to be stripped barren. So there is a connection there. Well, that could be. I haven't heard that, but that could be. In other words, the Torah gets to the point. It could be an interesting explanation. Okay. So again, the Midrashic interpretation is that this is not a geographical location of the discourse, but this is part of the tochacha itself. I'm wondering, does anyone have any other explanation? Because usually there are multiple explanations. I'm just aware of Rashi's comment for the 11 days. If anyone has a note there. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, the point is, where does it begin? That's the issue. But remember that the Jewish people, in effect, took a very circuitous route, even when they left Egypt, to get to the land of Israel. Remember, when they're in Egypt, they're west of Jordan, right? I mean, they're west of Israel. So, logically, there's no reason for them to go around the Dead Sea. What the Jewish people did is, they went south and east. They circled the Dead Sea, and then they went north, and now they find themselves in Jordan, modern-day Jordan, east of Jericho. Right, you have the picture there. That's not a sensible route. I mean, they're already west of Israel. They should just go up the Mediterranean coast. But the Chumash itself says, right, the Chumash itself says that God did not lead them up the Mediterranean coast because they would have encountered the Philistines, and the Philistines were such fierce warriors that that would have driven them back to Egypt. So God's plan was a circuitous route that went eastward across at least some of the northern Arabian deserts, and then they turn north and they find themselves east of the Jordan River. So they did circle the Dead Sea. Now, the Chumash's geography does not correspond with modern designations. As far as the Chumash is concerned, any area south of the Dead Sea is already defined as the land of Seir. So all this refers to is they turned the tip of the southern Dead Sea, and then they turned north. So it was 11 days, essentially, we could say, to generalize, 11 days from Mount Sinai to the southern edge of the Dead Sea. And they essentially sent the spies from that edge. That's where Kadesh Barnea is. And from that point, they wandered in that general area for 38 years. They didn't wander, contrary to popular opinion, they didn't wander for 40 years. The 40 years are from the Exodus to coming to the land of Israel. But they didn't send the spies till 2 years after they left Egypt. So really it was 38 years extra of wandering. So God is making the point, you know, that distance takes 11 days to cover from Mount Sinai to the Dead Sea. You covered it in 3 days. So God was in a hurry. And yet, because of the Meraglim, you wind up wandering for 38 years. But again, so much of this is unstated. It doesn't even say in the verse that it was a three-day journey, but apparently that was a very vivid tradition that the new generation preserved and remembered, and Moshe did not have to mention it explicitly. Okay, but again, as I say, contextually, Pasuk Bet is a difficult Pasuk. Okay, now Pasuk Gimel tells us the when, not the where, the when. And that is fairly clear. It says, Vayihi, and it was, Be'arboim Shana. It was the 40th year of the Israelites' exodus from Egypt. The last year, the 40th year. Be'ashtei Asar Chodesh. Okay, Ashtei. Okay, if it says Shtei Asar, that is 12. Ashtei Asar it's only used in Biblical Hebrew, is used for 11. So Ashtei Asar Chodesh, the 11th month, which is Shvat. Be'achad L'chodesh, the first of the month, remember Rosh Chodesh, Shvat. Diber Moshe el Bnei Yisrael. Moses now speaks to Bnei Yisrael. Kichol asher tziva Hashem oto. In accordance with all that God has commanded him, aleihem to them. Now again, this poses somewhat of a question, I think, on what we discussed earlier. We discussed earlier at great length that the book of Devarim are Moses' own words. They're not the words that God told him. But the truth is, that could be confirmed from this verse. It doesn't say Moses spoke to Bnei Yisrael, call all that God told him. That would have implied that he's simply communicating God's message. Kichol means in accordance, meaning to say he is taking all that he learned from God and he is formulating it in his own message before he leaves. Kichol, that's why kichol, in accordance with. In other words, Moses' message is consistent with God's teachings, but the formulation of that message is Moses' formulation. And of course, since we believe these words were dictated by God, God is confirming that. God is saying, what Moses said is in accordance with my views. Okay, then we have another when. Acharei hakoto Eit Sichon Melech Ha'emori Asher Yoshev B'cheshvon B'yeit Og Melech HaBashan Asher Yoshev B'ashtarot B'edrei. Okay, so one when is, the first when is in verse 3, when the 40th year, Rosh Chodesh Shvat. The second when is, this took place after two major military campaigns. have been successfully completed. Now, where do you read about these military campaigns? Again, this is alluding to the book of Numbers. You would not know anything about this unless you read the book of Numbers. But at the end of the book of Numbers, if you remember, let me go over the history a little bit, because to understand this you have to know that history. The Jewish people in the 40th year have now circled the Dead Sea, and they're east. Okay, they're east of Israel. But in order for them to get to the Jordan River, they have to go through certain countries or certain nations that live in that east bank. Among them are the Moabites. Now the Moabites don't let them go through, and the Moabites do not offer them food and water. Then there's the Edomites, the people of Esau, same thing. And God specifically tells the Jewish people, do not wage war against the nations of Moab, because they are descended from Lot, who is Abraham's nephew, and they are not to be disturbed. Do not wage war against the Edomites, because they are from Esau. They are not to be disturbed. All right. So the Jews are going further north and north. They bypass the Moab country. Well, Esau is first. They bypass Esau's country on the south. They bypass the Moabites. And then finally they reach, remember, they're east of this, but they have to go west to get to the Jordan River. So the final block there is the Amorite kingdom. Of course, the Amori are a group of people who also live in Canaan proper. And Sihon, the king of the Amorites, declares war on the Jewish people. And God commands the Jews to fight against Sihon, Melech Amori. And although Sihon was a very, very fierce military leader, the Jewish people conquer the land of Sihon. And that is the egress, as it were, that is the land which is then given to the 2.5 tribes, and that is the base from which the Jews enter, cross the Jordan, and enter Jericho. Okay? That is the land of Sihon. And then they turned north to the Bashan. The Bashan is the area of the Golan Heights. The Bashan, a very fertile, high, elevated area, and the king there is a fellow called Og, the king of Bashan. Og has a lot of legends in Midrashim about Og. Og was repeatedly a tremendous giant. And not only that, but Og was a survivor. Og was around a long time. The tradition goes that Og was even around during the time of the flood of Noah, and he was too big to get into the flood, but he just held on from the outside and he managed to survive. There's another Midrash that says when Avraham was later informed that his nephew Lot was captured by the four kings, it was Og that informed him, because Og was hoping that Avram would get killed in war and he could marry Sarah. And so the difference there. So Og is around in a lot of different contexts and the like. But nevertheless, the land of Og. So again, just keep in mind approximately where this is. The land of Sichon is Transjordan. It's the east bank of the Jordan, around where Jericho is. In other words, directly opposite of Jericho on the west. And the strip is probably... it's a plain till it reaches the mountain, so it's probably 15 to 20 miles east-west, or west-east, 15 to 20 miles wide, and it's probably around 50 miles north-south. That's the strip that we're talking about, is the land of Sichon, and that was the land given to the 2.5 tribes, and then north around the Golan Heights, around Syria, was a strip that was conquered from Og, the king of Bashan, and that was also given to the 2.5 tribes. So what we have is this. Why is this significant? That's the problem. In other words, why does the Torah feel it essential to emphasize that Moshe is giving his musar, his rebuke, specifically after the conclusion of this military conquest? So Rashi makes the point that Moshe needs to be very pragmatic here. If Moshe were to give people musar and criticism before he's delivered on the goods, so to speak, people will think, who gives this guy a right to give us any musar at all? He promises us a land of milk and honey. He promises us a place that we will live. And we've gotten nothing but wandering around for 38 years in the desert. So Moshe understood that he had to deliver the goods before he's in a position to give them musar. And that's why it emphasizes he did not begin his discourses till he had conquered for them the land of Sichon and the land of Og. So it's a pragmatic viewpoint. Okay. And then, finally, the fifth verse says, again, it was Abraham Yardain, the land of Moab. Moshe began, Ha'il Moshe Be'er, Moses began to explain the Torah. So in other words, the point is, this is identifying a secondary function, meaning Devarim has two functions. It is Musar, it is chastisement, it is criticism, it is introspection, and it is Torah. It is to give them the mitzvot. You see how these two functions are encapsulated. The Musar is by indirect reference to places and geography and distance. And then verse 5 says, it's not just Musar, but it's to explain the Torah, explain the commandments, explain the duties that you have to do, which is an important thing. In other words, it's not enough to criticize. You can't just tell people the negatives and the faults. You have to give them a positive context to their lives, and that is the secondary function. Okay, so this is the circumscription of the book, which kind of sets the tone for what follows, and now we have a discourse. Now let me just say, though, that the Book of Devarim is divided into several discrete discourses, and the so-called first discourse of Moshe lasts all the way from chapter 1, verse 6, to chapter 4. Let me find that. Chapter 4. Trying to find it. Chapter 4, verse 40. Because then there's a brief return of the omniscient narrator who disappeared for a long time. So that normally signifies, when the narrator comes back, that signifies that a new discourse is going to begin. Okay, so we'll try to look at these as units, although I doubt we'll be able to cover an entire discourse. But if you want to read ahead or look at things, I would suggest you try to at least read the verses from chapter 1, verse 6, to chapter 4, verse 40. And try to take that as a single structural unit as to what Moses is trying to accomplish. Which is why, by the way, the traditional division of the Torah into the Parsha of the Week is not necessarily the most helpful way of understanding the Book of Devarim, because those are not the internal divisions of the book itself. Right? In other words, the more appropriate internal division would be to look at the single discourse of Moshe, what are its components and what was he trying to do. Okay, I'm sorry, I don't have a clock here. Okay, maybe we'll stop this. Yes, the discourse begins chapter 1, verse 6, and it goes till chapter 4, verse 40. So that cuts into all of this parsha and half of next week, half of the next parsha. But that is the more logical division, because that is the speech as Moshe gave it. By the way, you know, people today are very impatient if a rabbi speaks more than 10 minutes. But if we assume that a single discourse was delivered in a single time, then we have to assume that Moshe gave this entire discourse, those four chapters, in one sitting. Well, one can time. Read it and see how long it takes to say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, well, yeah, Farrakhan. Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to have to talk to Rabbi Halpern. I think we can make it, but it might be difficult, so we'll have to consider the rescheduling for the Erev of all the holidays. Oh, next week we're having it. Yeah. Well, but after that, we'll have to make a decision. Yeah. A map of location? I'll see if I can get one. I mean, there are good biblical atlases that give you a sense of things. I'll try to see if I can get a Xerox of it. Yeah. I'm sorry, they said they would not be? I'm sorry, are you requesting that, or somebody told you that was the... Okay, well, I'll try to find out, and by next week we'll announce it. Okay. Yeah, give it to the office. Okay, have a good week. Did what? We don't know, in other words, he didn't know the day of his death. But he knew this was imminent because he knew that he was not... Remember, he knew that he could not enter the land of Israel. He also knew the Jewish people were what would wander only 40 years. So given the fact that this is the 40th year, he knows that they're going to be entering, and he knows he can't go with them. So two and two together means he's going to die. And remember, that same year, Aaron had already died, and Miriam had already died. So, thank you very much. Thank you. Okay. Thank you again. I really appreciate it.
What about these?
Yes, anything you can see.
Can you do me a favor? Would there be a mechanism of the readability of the